The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is the Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalogs of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week's episode features a conversation with Antti, a member of Moscow Anarchist Black Cross, about the call out for solidarity with Russian anarchists and anti-fascists. This starts off with a description of the cases of Dmitry Butchenkov, Alexei Gaskarov, Alexei Sutuga, Ilya Romanov, Alexander Kolchenko, and Elizaveta Svetkova. Each of these prisoners are inside because of their activism and are considered political prisoners, locked in the Putinist prison system. During the hour, Antti, who was exiled from Russia, talks about the cases of these six, a more general context of anarchist and Antifa action in Russia these days, and about the prison system in Russia. The original call-out can be found at the Autonomous Action website in English, Spanish, Russian, and other languages at avtonom.org by clicking the English tab and searching.
Here is a brief announcement. Kara Wilde is an artist, comrade, and resilient force of nature currently being detained in France for her alleged participation in a protest against draconian labor reforms and police repression. She is a trans woman and is currently being held in a men's jail without access to hormones. She is also a U.S. citizen and has been denied bond because French authorities consider her a flight risk. On May 18th, thousands of people converged in Paris to defy an ongoing siege of police violence and to oppose a new neoliberal labor reform. During one of these marches, a police car was attacked and set on fire. Kara was brutally arrested in connection to this incident more than one full week later at a separate event. She is currently being accused of, quote, attempted voluntary manslaughter of a person holding public office, destruction of property, group violence, and participating in a masked armed group, end quote. Kara is among six people currently facing charges in connection to this incident. To make matters worse, France's Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, is vowing to execute unrelenting punishment in order to set an example and demobilize protests. You can learn more about this situation and donate to Kara Wilde's support effort by visiting the website freekarawild.org. That's K-A-R-A-W-I-L-D. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll call like a bomb! At the time of this writing, roughly 50 people had to die at an Orlando nightclub because one adherent to a particularly intolerant and sectarian strain of Islam was allegedly offended not so long ago when he ostensibly witnessed two gay men expressing affection. This is a really impossible thing to wrap the mind around, a senseless carnage. While I share the revulsion expressed by those in media paid to dictate to us how to feel and what to think, I don't share their conclusions as to the problem and how to solve it. This is not a matter of keeping guns out of the hands of the Omar Mateens, and it isn't about formulating a kind of global group counseling approach to get ISIS sympathizers to be more tolerant. What we need is to first view the problem in its historical context. We can't take issue with the leaves without first understanding the trees and the forest in which the leaves arise. Point of fact, intolerance is not a value indigenous to Islam. Consider at the time of the Prophet of Islam, the first generation of Muslims were driven out of their hometown of Mecca and subjected to incredible cruelties. Years later, when a vast army of Muslims returned to Mecca and entered the city with almost no bloodshed, Muhammad made clear that there was to be no retribution, not even against those who had defiled the body of his own beloved uncle Hamza. The Muslims were not to return cruelty for cruelty. In the generations after the death of the Prophet, as Islam spread, it swept in the most peaceful epoch in that region. By all accounts, under Muslim rulers, Christians and Jews practiced their own faiths unmolested, without forced conversions. There was virtually no strife. The Muslim government of Jerusalem was the most tolerant that city had ever experienced. Not until Christian crusaders came did that tolerant orientation change. Christian fighters subjected the entire region to brutal atrocities, leaving a wake of devastation, death, and burning books. Those Christian conquerors introduced their Muslim captives to the idea that might makes right, that conquerors should rule the conquered, mercilessly imposing themselves upon the defeated in a ruthless and unforgiving way. Christian invaders introduced their Muslim subjects to the new norm of forced conversions and inquisitions, the new norm of absolute intolerance. The lesson stuck. Muslim regimes after the Crusades never demonstrated the same tolerance as the regimes prior to the Crusades, and for a practical reason, the wolves were always at the door. Christian and Jewish minorities in their midst were potential agents of subversion for their ruthless enemies, agents to be neutralized. As a general rule, it only takes one player to place a pistol on the poker table, and the days of a friendly card game are over. We fast forward to the modern era, we've got an ostensibly Christian invader in the First Oil War, obliterating a Muslim nation without provocation, bombing water treatment facilities and the foreseeable result of making children die. We've got a decade of sanctions to kill 500,000 children under the age of six, and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright saying that their deaths were the acceptable cost of ousting Saddam Hussein. They've got the humiliation of bases throughout the region to facilitate bombers up the baby killers. They've got billions of dollars funding an illegal colonizer state of Israel, imposing an apartheid of religious and ethnic intolerance. As a general rule, when somebody else puts a pistol on the table, pretty soon everyone has a pistol. If you can't beat them, join them. So these are all the factors contributing to an ever more distorted, more intolerant strain of Islam. One that aspires to be as brutal, as cruel, as sectarian, and as intolerant as the forces arrayed against it. Let's not forget how our Nobel Prize-winning president took out a third world wedding party with a drone, leaving more casualties than Omar Mateen left in Orlando. In this context, the problem is not the Omar Mateens or the guns available to them. The problem is a hyper-insensitive and hyper-intolerant atmosphere fueled principally today by U.S. gunboat democracy. So if we want to prevent the next massacre and the next, and if we want to foster a resurgence of a more peaceful and tolerant Islam, one that's more consistent with its original character, we might have to begin by finding a way to get those Muslim children off the tips of those American swords. Otherwise, this is the new normal, what Malcolm X referred to as chickens come home to roost. And there are still a lot of chickens out there that haven't come home yet. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Warren Correctional Institution of Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205. Warren C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
We're speaking with a member of Moscow Anarchist Black Cross about the International Days of Solidarity with Russian anarchist and anti-fascist prisoners from July 1st to July 10th. Do you care to introduce yourself further?
Yeah, my name is Ante Laudian, and actually I'm not currently living in Moscow because I got deported from Russia around 4 years ago, so I'm kind of exiled member, but I'm still involved in the Moscow Anarchist Black Cross.
I was going to ask if there were many members working internationally with Moscow Anarchist Black Cross.
More or less now, right now, the group is not like very active. It's maybe two or three people in Moscow. Moscow, it has been like people are going in and out. I'm basically like more or less, if there is like international correspondence, I'm more or less taking care of it. And people in Moscow, they are more in the working with the local prisoners in Russian side.
So the folks that are named in the call-out published at avtonom.org were Dmitry, and please correct me if I pronounce any of these wrong, but yeah. Dmitry...
Butchenkov,
okay.
Yeah.
Dmitry Butchenkov, Alexei Gaskarov, Alexei Sutuga, Ilya Romanov, Alexander Kolchenko, and Elizaveta Svetkova.
Yeah, this is right now. It's just more or less how it should be pronounced.
Can you tell listeners about these folks and the circumstances of their arrests and confinement?
Yeah, okay. There are all like partially different histories, and some things are also the same. So this was like an attempt just to put all of these people together to one call. Like it's... Because like last couple of years, it has been like drop of activity in Russia, and also like some, how to say, drop of international links, because partially because like anti-fascists thing, and kind of this conflict between fascist and anti-fascist has been a bit going down. In Russia, it's more or less like government repression and these kind of things, but it's a bit different networks who are working on this kind of thing. So this was... This international call was attempt to revitalize the existing networks and maybe create some new networks and to raise interests of these prisoners, because I don't think like the stories are so like much known. So the first two prisoners, Dmitry Butchenko and actually I start with Butchenko and Gaskarov because they are in the same case. It's this so-called Bolotnaya case. It's from the 2012 inauguration day, or actually 2 days, I think, before inauguration of Putin, after he had once again won the election, third time, actually. So it was kind of a bit like last attempt of the opposition to put up some resistance, and it ended up to... a riot, pretty much due to police provocation, because none of this demonstration against election fraud had been there has been like any violent conflict before this, and this was used for by the Russian authorities as a pretext to completely repress all the kind of opposition, because there were all the kinds of basically everyone except the governing parties and the parties close to them, like the parliamentary parties, which are pretty much loyal, not organizing any real opposition, but all the like opposition outside the parliament was involved in this anti-electionary fraud movement, which was biggest thing in Russia for 20 years. But eventually, 6th of May, 4 years ago, it was crushed, and around 30 people landed up to jail, and actually the arrests are still going on. It's still like this year... Even 4 years later, some people got arrested, and Alexei Gaskarov was arrested some months after this demonstration, but Butchenko was arrested only 5 years ago. And especially with like Gaskarov was at least present there and tried to save some people from the police onslaught, because he is a kind of guy who can't just stand by when he sees people beaten up by the police, but obviously he was not involved in anything more. But Butchenko was not even around, but still he's active person, active. Dima has been like Dmitry. It's Dima is the shortened name. Has been active in the anarchist and anti-fascist movement since the late 90s. So he was just picked up because he was a known person. So they kind of also like to pick up people who they are known activists. And Alexei is actually going to be released after 5 years. It's apparently once again, like a couple of weeks ago, his appeal to be released on probation was rejected. So he will be doing the whole time. He was giving like 3.5 years ticket. And Butchenko, we don't know. Like it's obviously like these charges are totally trumped, but I don't see like people I think it's quite unlikely that he will be at this point in Russia. More than 99% of the people who get arrested, they get sentenced eventually. So there are little chances. As for the other, yeah.
Well, just to, yeah, so yeah. You mentioned with Butchenkov that he wasn't even there at the time. Like, what I'm reading is saying that he was actually in Nizhny Novgorod, like 300 yeah. kilometers away from Moscow when the actual demonstration happens. How does the process, I mean, okay, anarchist to anarchist, I know that the state is corrupt and the courts will suppress whoever they want to suppress, but how did that get discussed in court or in the media, or is it just totally rolled over by the state?
It's just, one thing I wanted to say, that Gaskarov is, like as for these people, like the other people are anarchist, but Gaskarov lately doesn't really call himself such, but he has also been, Gaskarov has been years involved in anarchist movement and is also like obviously anti-fascist activist. But Butchenkov definitely, like his self-definition is libertarian communist, but as we know, it's pretty much the same. And as for the, we don't really yet see what will happen in the court, because at this point he's been just remanded. Imprisonment can easily take 1 year before you get sentenced. So obviously press is discussing this stuff, but like there is kind of independent and alternative media in Russia, but it's just like one radio station and a couple of papers. And in television, of course, they don't show any. If this is has been showed in television, they won't discuss this. Discuss this like discrepancies, because television is completely state controlled. But we don't see what happens in the court, but most likely like there will be some specialist who will show these photographs of Butchenkov and this other guy who is not Butchenkov, and they say, okay, it's the same guy, and then he will get some sentence. So this is most likely what happens, but of course we can hope that it can be different, because from time to time there are like honest judges in Russia as well, and honest prosecutors, but as I said, it's less than 1% of the cases. So there is not so much hope on this.
Okay, yeah, that answered my question. If you wanted to get on with the rest of them.
Yeah, so the rest of the people are for other cases. Alexander Kolchenko is... he's like long-time anarchist activist from Crimea. The area which was taken over 2 years ago by Russia after the Ukrainian events. And he was involved in the small group which somehow attempt to oppose this takeover, and they didn't really manage to do much. There were some like pretty small underground resistance actions, but for this, like Kolchenko get a 10-year sentence, and I think other people got even more. And there were like people with quite different political motivations. Kolchenko was like, how to say, different political ideas, but Kolchenko was the only anarchist involved, so this is why we kind of give more attention to him, because most of the, it's been pretty much like in Russia and Ukraine and all around Europe, the attention has been in Oleg Sentsov, who was, because he was a movie director, there has been some international movie festivals where participators have been appealing for Oleg Sentsov. He's more famous, but Kolchenko was in the same group. And we want, because he's like normal, just working class guy, and we want to kind of give his perspective. But so there has been some hopes that he will be swapped, because there has been some more high-profile prisoners of war have been swapped between Ukraine and Russia, but this far Kolchenko has not been swapped, and they also even claim that want to force him to accept Russian citizenship, which is pretty ridiculous, like because they kind of, all the Crimeans, they said that, okay, you are now Ukrainian, so also he must accept the Russian passport and stuff like this. So, and this way, of course, he wouldn't be eligible to swap to Ukraine or anything. So it's pretty kind of difficult situation in these respects. But of course, there are some hopes that he will be swapped eventually. And then three other prisoners, Alexei Sutuga. He's been more than 10 years active in the anarchist movement. He was he's originally from Siberia, from Irkutsk. But he moved to Moscow around 10 years ago, I think. And was also like of the prisoners, Butchenko and Gaskarov and Sutuga, they all have been involved in the autonomous action at different points. Sotuga is, I think, only person who is still, which is libertarian communist organization active in Russia and some, and also sometimes in Ukraine and Belarus, but currently I think there are only Russian groups. Sotuga was I think the main reason that he is in prison is that he's a prominent street-level anti-fascist and was kind of how these people go to kind of how the police and the so-called FSB, which is the secret service, and anti-extremist server, how they pick these people up, that they follow like Nazi discussions, because Nazis, of course, they start to learn people who are a pain in their ass, because they see each other in the street, and Sotuga was already quite famous in Irkutsk and quite feared by the local Nazis. So then, because he has this reputation, then eventually authorities started to target him, and he was originally... First time he was arrested, I think, 2011, there was a fight in some hardcore concert, because there were some fascists in the security, obviously not surprising that things got escalated. But he was released in the amnesty of 2012, I think, together with the Pussy Riot and many other prisoners. But only like 1 year after this, he was arrested once again with claim to have been fighting with some fascist, which is also like quite likely. Like, I don't see lots of problems with... I don't think it's necessary problem to fight with the Nazis, but his charges were pretty dubious. But his... has been sent, and he's been sent to Siberia, where he's still officially registered with, and is in pretty, like, prisoner administration wants to really crack his down. He was even in the hunger strike at some point, because at some point all his correspondence and all the communication were just rejected. So he's been having some difficult times. Then Ilya Romanov is, of all of these people listed, he is the most... person who has been arrested, like active in the anarchist movement for the longest time. He was actually already active in the Soviet Union in the late 80s from Nizhny Novgorod. As Butchenkov is the, currently it's the fifth most biggest city in Russia and the third most biggest in the western part of the Russia. It was called Gorky in the Soviet times. And also it's a city which is kind of more repressive. It used to be a closed city, kind of a huge prison in the Soviet times, a military center. So this is why it's more repressive than Moscow and St. Petersburg. Anyway, Romanov has been actually in prison already almost continuously for the last 14 years. Originally, he was arrested as a suspect for armed organization called New Revolutionary Alternative in the late 90s. But he was, instead of a court, he was sent to mental hospital, which is also kind of traditional control method. It was pretty much used in the Soviet Union, that the dissidents were not imprisoned, but sent to mental hospital, and he was released in 2002. He moved to Ukraine, and after 1 year, in autumn of 2003, there was arrested the members of a suspected armed group. And they were very heavily tortured. One of the arrested persons actually died for the torture, and the rest were given lengthy prison sentence, and Romanov got a 10-year sentence, and he was released. He was not released before doing his time. He was doing the full time and released, I think, 2013, and he moved back to Nizhny Novgorod, where his family is from. And eventually, like around 1 year after that, he was arrested with... He just tried to make a firecracker. We don't know exactly what happened. Romanov is saying that he just made a minor firecracker just for the interest of it. But it failed, and it blew up in his hand, and he lost, like, I guess, one finger or something. But pretty much kind of small thing, but somehow authorities decided that he wanted to create some sort of terrorist plot and one-person terrorist organization, which means that, and eventually he was given, which means that he will be doing a long time in prison, and he was eventually given a long prison sentence because of this. So this is obviously a case which is less profilic than the previous ones. Romanov hasn't got so much connection, obviously, like liberal organization and human rights organization are not so interested about this kind of case, but we think it's like legal outrage, and we try to somehow keep this up, and because obviously the sentence has to be appealed and there are legal costs and so on. So the last person, Elisaveta, he was arrested in Tagarong. She's actually only person who is not like a veteran of the movement, but from peripheric city, the Tagarong. So she was just putting up some anti-police leaflets in the city because police brutality, as in most of the world, or pretty much in all the countries, it's also a big problem in Russia. So she was just putting up some anti-police leaflets, and because sometimes these anti-liberal laws, and also sometimes laws against, inciting national hatred, they are used to defend police, because the law is pretty vague, and it's kind of inciting hatred against a group of people. So sometimes they claim that politicians are also a group of people, or capitalists, or the police.
In the way that, so, like, these laws are ostensibly defined to not allow people to attack Roma people, or, Russian nationals or Ukrainian nationals or whatever, right? It's meant to be like anti-hate crime legislation, but they're defining police as a social group in that way?
Yeah, okay. That's exactly the case. And actually, I think there is even a precedent in the highest, in the Constitutional Court of Russia, that this law cannot be used this way. But anyway, Russian judges and the law, legal system, they are not so, they maybe don't know so much what's the constitutional court position on different things, so they keep giving these kind of sentences. And obviously, if in some city the cops and the prosecutor want something to happen, it's not so easily for the judges to do otherwise. So obviously, it's possible that this sentence will not survive the appeal, but at this point, it seems that she has to be do this so-called work dati for 1 year, which means it's kind of, I don't know how it's called in US, it's kind of you go to some work, which is probably, in the Soviet times it was called chemia, because, like, chemistry, because this was usually some very horrible chemical plants. Nowadays it can be better, and also I guess it's a problem that they don't have actually so many workplaces, so maybe it is just prison. It's a pretty long sentence and thing to do for just putting up some leaflets.
It's funny leaflets. That, like, I mean, not funny, but it's pretty incredible and horrible that the state is acting in that way. I was just, when I read that this morning about Elisaveta's case, I was like, oh, that's funny. The state of Louisiana in the U.S. enacted a hate crimes law to protect police this last year, defining them as a social group that can be attacked, and so you get extra charges.
Yeah, so apparently there are same kind of sentences, like same kind of tendencies in Russia and some American states.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, first, for listeners that may not know, and you just mentioned that the work release colonies are sort of a low security alternative to, like, full-on prison in Russia and the Russian Federation. But can you talk about what different forms of incarceration look like?
In Russia, there is still, like, the system which was developed in the Soviet time is that actually people don't do their prison sentences in prison. They do them usually in the labor camps. And people are only in prison during the remand time. And there are good and bad sides on this. This because in the work camp, basically, there is lots of more space to move around. You move to the workplace, you move up. There is usually people living in the barracks. And inside the barracks, I guess during most of the day, you can move around rather freely. So there are kind of more space than in many American prisons, because I guess in the US, it's you can often be like locked down 23 hours a day or something. But also the work can be very exhaustive, and they have also like production quotas and stuff like this. So in, especially in the women's camps, they can be that they put you to work for 12 hours a day, and even worse, in very bad conditions. So basically, they can pretty much at some times they can ruin your health and so on. So it's kind of how to say it's hard to say if it's actually better. Like in some respects it's a better system, and in some respects it's a worse. Remand prisons, they are usually heavily overcrowded. Especially women's remand prisons, they can be and even in the men's remand prison, often you sleep in three shifts. That there is like basically beds for 10 persons, and there are 30 persons in the cell. So it's like heavily overcrowded. But usually you spend in this remand prison like 1 or 2 years before your sentence. But in some cases, like in some economic crimes and so on, it can take even more time if it's a complicated case. So this is basically the two things. And then there is this like camp system. There is, how to say, any yet existing system of, domestic arrest or home arrest. If you are having this tagged leg thing or something,
yeah.
they used it during the investigation time instead of remanding, but not very often. Like basically in Russia, the police is pretty much willing to put people to prison because it's a very effective way to pressure people to confess. And many people, after spending like half years in the remand prisons, they just really want to go to the prison colony and are kind of ready to admit anything. Like there is now like this special American cases that the court system is kind of trade, that you most of the people are not sentenced, but instead they trade some kind of confession. It's pretty special American say this doesn't really exist so much in Russia. And also the juries they used to be used more often in the 90s, because in the 90s there was legal reform which made they replaced the Soviet system with a more American one. But eventually they realized that people don't really want to do jury duty, and also jury often released people, which in point of view of the cops should have gone to prisons. So now the juries are pretty much not existing, and instead there is, except in some quite special cases.
This is the Final Straw Radio on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. We're speaking with Antti, a member of the Moscow Anarchist Black Cross, about the International Days of Solidarity with Russian anarchist and anti-fascist prisoners from July 1st to July 10th. Do the courts charge people a lot of court fees? Because I see in Elisaveta's case, she's being charged 6,000 rubles in court costs.
No, it's not. And 6,000 rubles, it's like $100. So obviously, like the in Russian, peripheric cities, it's some money, but it's not like unbearable things. So it's not so common. And also there is not like many, at least in Finland, they often the most biggest problem can be the criminal compensation, which can be huge, but it doesn't really so much exist in Russia. It's still, in a way, in the core, it's like Soviet system. It doesn't count on financial punishment, but just wants to take your liberty. So it's kind of state socialist system still in these respects. And what else? Basically, the sentencing line was still 10 or 15 years ago, it was way more liberal than in USA. Like people even arrested for and sentenced for armed struggle, they could get sentences of 4 years or 6 years or 8 years. Obviously not kind of armed struggle that you kill something, but still I think in the US if you put some bomb, it's still quite much more, unless you can trade some good sentence. But now they have made plenty of different anti-terrorist amendments, so now you basically can even get a life sentence for, like they just last week, they accepted a new law according to which you can get a life sentence for financially supporting a terrorist organization, which is obviously pretty, how to say, vague, also like unclear, like what is this, like what's terrorist organization? It's probably pretty much can be, anything can be defined as a terrorist organization, and it's actually pretty much used. They also use nowadays anti-extremist legislation against Jehovah's Witnesses, which is because they are kind of not accepting other religions or something, so this is why they are terrorists. So there are all this kind of ridiculous stuff going on. Life sentence in Russia is pretty horrible. It was because of the European Council regulation, they had to abolish the death sentence in the 90s. So in place of the death sentence, they put the life sentence, but these life sentence colonies, they are pretty much hell on earth. You are just being kind of, if you go outside of cell, they just chain you so that you hold your hands up or something, so you never even see the ceiling. You just see the floor when you are walking around. So, and some of them are located in the far north, so the air is freezing all the time. So, like, there are all the kinds of things to have. It's like super strict discipline there, so this life sentence is not necessarily better than the death sentence. And basically, after 25 years, you should be eligible for parole, but it has never happened. Like, none of the people doing life sentence had never been paroled this far. It's because, like, first people got eligible for parole around this year because they have been, people have been sentenced in the early 90s, because 25 years is the minimum. But basically, for even most minor, how to say, disciplinary measures, like most minor breach of discipline, it's always plus 3 years. So it's possible that it's not possible to get released from the life sentence. No anarchist or leftist have been given like the serious sentence, but it's more like they give this to Islamists and Nazis. Like several Islamists and Nazis have been given life sentences, but now if there is a law that financing a terrorist organization might result a life sentence, so we will see what will happen.
So I guess with a case where it's argued that there's a significant threat to public safety in terms of, like, quote unquote terrorism, I can see how the state can make the argument that it's necessary to imprison someone for such a long period of time or to refuse them release. In the United States, you have cases where there's private companies that are facilitating certain levels of the incarceration, whether it be food production or laundry, or are making money off of the labor of people that are in the inside or running the whole prison. And elected officials, including judges, are oftentimes more likely to get reelected and get support from law enforcement agencies for being harsher on criminals during their sentencing and holding people for longer times. But in the Russian context, what is the motivation, do you think, like, that's specific to the Russian context for giving people such long sentences and refusing to release them if it's not a privatized circumstance?
Like, there is this kind of privatized element to some extent is also happening in Russia, but it has been quite difficult to develop business models with these prison colonies for some reason. I don't really know why. It could be that many of them are located in peripheric places and so on. So this not like... there are like lots of individual cases of exploitation of prison labor, which can be... like a very, ugly exploitation, especially in the women's colonies, but it's still not the kind of, it's not the general business development of exploitation of the prison labor. And also like this more harsher sentences, they mostly go to political crimes and sort of anti-terrorist crimes, which in terms of the general prison population, it's pretty marginal part. Like, of course, like in global terms, it could be probably several thousands of people have been sentenced of different terrorist crimes during the last 15 years because of the heavy resistance in the Chechnya, for example. There have been hundreds of prisoners of the Chechen resistance movement were prisoned with this kind of sentences, but still it's not a big part of the prison population. And also the general sentences guidelines, it's much more harsher than in the Europe in general, but it's more lenient than in US, definitely, in everywhere except these anti-terrorist crimes. To most of the economic and violent crimes, you seldom get more than 10 years, whereas in the US, I think you can easily get a very long sentence if you don't manage to bargain a good deal. But in general, the logic, and actually prison population in the Russia has been mostly decreasing for the last 20 years since the collapse of the like relative prison population, whereas in the US it's the contrary. But I guess during the last couple of years it has been in the race again, because this kind of thing has to do with the economy. If there are economic problems, people move to like less legal sort of businesses. But and there is not this democratic element. It's also a specific U.S. thing that the sheriffs and the judges and prosecutors get elected. It's completely detached from any kind of democratic control. It's totally from top to down. The ministries and the presidents are controlling the legal system and no one else. And it's also often used as a means to get rid of the political opponents. For example, businessmen who are not loyal to president and these kind of people. But motivation is, I think, like in general, Russia is also a conservative place, and many people consider a crime as a problem, especially after the 90s, because what happened in the Soviet Union is that there was quite a big criminal class, because there were so much of the economic activity which was in somehow normal in the capitalist countries was illegal, like showing movies to your friends. It could end you up in jail and very basic kind of trade and this kind of thing. So there was kind of big economic areas which were pushed to illegality, which facilitated the development of bigger and strong organized crime. Then in the 90s, when the Soviet system collapsed, this organized crime, it was suddenly one of the alternatives. And these people were heavily involved in all the kinds of business ventures, especially in the security areas, but the other areas as well. And many of these organized crime figures apparently managed to legalize themselves and get big properties. But there was a huge kind of war for survival, and thousands of people got killed in the different criminal wars in the 90s, so kind of people are somehow got concerned of the high level of crime and influence of the organized crime and so on, and pretty much prefer like harsh measures. And especially there is also quite very conservative attitudes of the drug trade, because like drug issue is very big in Russia. It's, I guess, there are some statistics that it's the third highest number of heroin addicts in the world, because like Afghanistan is basic in somehow in the Russian border, the borders in the Central Asia are not much controlled. So there are a high number of heroin addicts, lots of like grass and hashish and also synthetic drugs. It has to do with different things, with the general like problems in the society, economic crisis and this kind of thing. But the attitude of the public towards the drug issues is quite conservative, and people want to send the drug dealers to jail and want to send even the drug users to jail. And lots of course, most of the criminal system is filled with the drug sentences, and I guess that's the case also in most of the world. And it's pretty kind of, how to say, the current political climate, it's increasing kind of this, because after 90s crisis, the general social climate is moving to more conservative directions, because people kind of make parallels between liberal values and collapse of the economy. Even though actually, in my opinion, of course, the liberal reformers made the economy, and neoliberal reforms in the 90s made the economy much worse, but the fundamental problem was in the Soviet system. But people kind of want many things, much of the Soviet system back, and there is like backlash against everything which is considered liberal, like sexual minorities, national minorities, and different, social groups, including drug users. So this is kind of, I think this is part of the logic. So of course it's a bit like how the state system works. It's somehow detached of the general opinions because there is not like real democratic system, but in these ways it's also in the sink. I think like no one doubts that Russian society is moving to more conservative direction, and also it's the fact that lots of the people who don't like this way have migrated, like probably like half of the anarchists I know, or at least one third of the anarchists I knew in Moscow, they now live in other countries because simply they don't like the climate, this general mood in the society.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, you've described in some cases the specific circumstances being faced by anarchists and anti-fascists in terms of imprisonment, but can you tell the audience a little bit about what it's like being an anarchist or anti-fascist activist in Russia today? You said like it's a more conservative atmosphere and it drives people away. Are there any other inklings that could give to a better understanding to people who are listening and to about what the struggle is like there in Russia?
Well, it's, of course, you have to say that it's been like already 4 years ago I was deported. Before this, I was living 12 years in Moscow, and after these 4 years, lots of things have happened, because in general, Russian society it's quite dynamic, and there can be huge changes just in the couple of years, which is not the case in the North Europe, which is pretty, in the stagnation. But how I see it now, like there is a big crisis in the movement, after the movement against the anti-election, against election fraud, to which anarchists participated, was crushed, and this resulted in like huge depression. People kind of lost the perspective somehow. Some people moved to publishing projects and so on, but in the streets you cannot see so many anarchists. Like in the biggest anarchist blocks in Moscow, in this anti-election fraud demonstration could be 300 or even 500 people. But now you never see such numbers. So lots of the people kind of got disillusioned. Many people migrated. Many people are just afraid to show up because, as I said, it's still people are getting arrested for 2012 riots. So people who were there, they probably cannot show their faces anywhere because they may easily be picked up even now. So this is not the case. But on the other hand, what has happened in terms of the fascism is that level of fascist violence has dropped substantially. Of course, it's not disappeared. It used to be in the worst years. It was usually more than 100 racist murders in Russia. Like mostly, of course, people who got murdered, they were migrants, and only small parts were anarchist and anti-fascist. But every year, several anarchists got murdered, but now this doesn't happen anymore. There has been also fascist movement has been crushed as well, and there is also generation and tactical shifts in the fascist movement. So, kind of, you can fascists are not so much a threat anymore. They can be in the peripheral places, but not in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And you don't have to take when you organize events, you don't have to take account the fascist threat. You can have problems with the authorities more than before, but less so with the fascist. And this also character of the movement in these respects, especially in Moscow and St. Petersburg, has changed, because now there are more interest of issues which were which is queer issues because this whole LGBT issue has been quite big after this discrimination legislation. So here is, you actually, some comrades of mine say that it's only one which has been dynamic and growing during the couple of years, but we will see how far it goes. And also different cooperative stuff, because somehow it's more and more difficult to be active in the streets, so people move to like communal project and these kind of things. But this is also, of course, this is just my perspective of people who visit here from Moscow and St. Petersburg and people with whom I talk. But in general, what happened before 2012, that it was pretty much 15 years continuous growth of the movement, and quite a lot centered on anti-fascism, like first on environmental issues, then on anti-fascism, but now it's the whole like issues and discussion have changed, and there are lots of, like, some people are involved in the workplace things. I wouldn't say it's completely around feminism and queer issues, but so there are different kinds of things happening, also working place organizing, but anti-fascism is definitely less on the agenda. And as I said, like, many people are still, like, there is this general mood of depression because there were so many years of continuous growth and positive dynamics. So many people don't have any experience of backlashes before. So this, I think, has influenced a lot.
So back to the prisoners. What sorts of solidarity are being called for? Is there hope that outside pressure will force the hand of the authorities, or will give hope to the prisoners and others struggling to continue the fights on the inside, or of those being repressed?
Well, I'm pretty sure this actually one of the main goals of the action days is to have encourage the prisoners to remind that they are not alone, to see that something is happening, and this, I think, is one of the main goals. To put the pressure on the authorities, it could be pretty difficult. It could be maybe work to some extent with the case of Elizaveta Sletkova, because like she's in this, she was sentenced in the provincial place where people maybe don't get used to so much the attention, but with this higher, more profiling political cases, it's obviously quite difficult to have some direct influence, but at least, like what's the case in the Moscow Anarchist Black Cross that we didn't even, we were most of the time not even too optimistic about chances to create some sort of momentum, some pressure, but we want to give the best possible defense to our comrades, and for this best possible defense, you need funds. Because the lawyers are, as in all the countries where you cannot get properly state-funded lawyer of your free choice, the lawyers are expensive, and that's the case in Russia as well. So we try to get the best possible lawyer, but even the best possible lawyer, it usually means that you get 1 or 2 years less, but it doesn't mean that you'll get released. So this is basically what we try to do.
I was reading an interview, I think, from last year with Dmitry Butchenkov, where he was talking about being in prison and having it be difficult for him to be able to stay fit and also stay full when the commissary and the kitchen, like the cafeteria and the prison, don't provide enough food. So y'all are requesting funds also for a commissary for folks to buy food?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, basically, in Russia, especially in the remand in prisoners, but also in the colonies, this whole just feeding the prisoners has been it's the tasks of the relatives and friends. You don't get really proper food, and not even from the commissary. You get the system could have changed in some places, but basically in most of the places, you just have to go to shop or to the marketplace and buy food and take it to prison. So this is quite how it works. And this cost can also be like substantial. In some cases, it could be hundreds of dollars a month for these prisoners. And also, what's the situation that the movement is actually seldom capable to finance like mostly of this thing. Mostly, like, relatives are paying for the stuff, and people and oftentimes relatives and parents have been forced to sell their apartments to finance the court costs, for example. And of course, with the Black Cross, we try to do the best we can. best we can, but usually only the minor part of the costs have been provided for by us.
You've mentioned that that in Russia of recent, the threat of fascists in the street has been decreasing, and so a shift in perspective around Antifa stuff. In the United States, there's been a stronger surge of anti-fascist and anti-racist organizing over the last few years. For instance, just this week, anti-racists faced off against a group called Traditionalist Youth in Sacramento, California, leading to 7 hospitalized for stab wounds. Do you have any observations on this or words to offer to U.S. anti-racists and Antifa activists?
Yeah, I was following the situation. I was pretty shocked, and I really hope that people are getting well, both and also with Anaheim and now in Sacramento. It was pretty ugly and horrible what happened. But of course, there are some things in the Russia and U.S. are pretty similar, but it's obviously it's a bit different because the whole race issue in the U.S. is a bit different. And I was never expected like this kind of hardcore fascist to get even this far in U.S. But maybe now, like with the Trump going to be the presidential candidate, many things can happen. But I think actually like Sacramento thing, in many cases the things were well organized. It was not just anarchist, but it was lots of different parts of the community, and there has been quite high quality discussion on these things. So the things in this respect, I think things are going pretty well in the U.S. In the Sacramento, it seemed to be less marginalized than Antifa is in Russia, because in Russia in general Antifa never managed to be connected to much anything else except different youth subculture. So it was pretty well, but I hope that now after Anaheim and Sacramento things, people also start to work on the street level tactics, how to work in this kind of situation, because obviously we cannot afford to lose our comrades for the fact of being, not adequately prepared and planned in this kind of events. But anyway, I really hope that everyone who got wounded in Sacramento will get well and are back in the streets as soon as possible.
Finally, where can people find out more to support the 6 prisoners that we were talking about earlier in Russia?
So our group, Anarchist Black Cross of Moscow, we have our Facebook pages and Twitters. You can easily find us. We have both like separate English pages and Russian. It doesn't always work so well to separate languages, but we are working our best to have more social networks with just one language. Our website is we are guests in the Autonomous Action Federation website. We have our section there. You can just click go to autonom.org. It's avtonom.org and click the Anarchist Black Cross, so you get our updates in English. So these are basically the information sources. It's kind of not always possible to translate so much things in English, but we are trying to do our best, and obviously you can just write us by email, abc, defis, or msk at riseup.net. So, and we can give like more specific details if you have any questions. We have if someone is into donating, the best way is probably PayPal. It's also in our website. From the US, probably PayPal. If someone is listening from the Europe, there are other opportunities, but from the state, it's obviously PayPal, which is going to work out the best. So I guess this was pretty much where we are around. We tried to post stuff to main anarchist news sites as well, which have like contribution possibility, but from our own site you definitely find what's the latest news from us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. And I'm sorry about all the scheduling issues that we had.
Yeah.
But
it's no problem.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalogs of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.